Well, good morning. I'm really pleased that so few of you know me because it means I can have an open go with my jokes. That's really terrific. But before I say anything else, I want to introduce you to an old friend of mine. He doesn't know me, but I know him very well. I've known him for many years and he's been a tremendous help to me. Some of you possibly know him too, but his name is Derek Kidner. And I found his commentary on the Psalms and other commentaries absolutely terrific. This is the Tyndale commentary and I would highly recommend it. He has the capacity for making memorable statements such as, when we see the Lord, we will then have unquestionable answers to our present unanswerable questions. Isn't that terrific? That's the sort of statement that Derek Kidner goes in for in a big way. I'd love to meet him one day. As has already been mentioned, I was at Stanwell Tops last weekend and one of the highlights of it for me was spending some time talking to Jean Radden, who told me some of her best stories. Now, even though you don't know me very well, I'm sure you know Jean Radden. And it's possible that some of you have heard this story, but it's relevant to what I want to say, and it's worth repeating. It's the story of when she and two friends of hers were going to Keswick Convention from London, and they had to catch a train, and they were running late. They'd called for a taxi, and the taxi hadn't come. And eventually the taxi came and they rushed out and piled all their gear into it and piled into it themselves. And when they got to the station, Jean said to the man, how much is it? And he said, well, actually, I'm not a taxi driver. And she said, well, why didn't you say so? And he said, well, you never gave me a chance. You know, in our over-busy lives, one of the things that we do or fail to do very often is to give God a chance to say something to us. We're all pretty good at talking to God, but when it comes to making space in our lives to hear what He has to say, that's a different story. I'm so pleased that we're studying Psalms. I love the Psalms. As a matter of fact, I make it a daily habit to read a Psalm and one stanza of Psalm 119 every day. And I'd highly recommend that. It's a wonderful way of getting to be saturated with a Psalm that's all about the Word of God. So I'd highly recommend that. In Psalm 5, we read about David's own prayer life. And you might like to turn to Psalm 5. That's not the psalm that we're going to study. But it's just to convince us that we're really going along the right track. Because David, as Effie reminded us last night, was a man who made it a habit of inquiring of the Lord, and not only inquiring of the Lord, but waiting to hear what the Lord would say before he made a move. And so in the first three verses of Psalm 5, we read a beautiful little outline of David's own prayer life. And I'll just read it from the NIV. Give ear to my words, O Lord. Consider my sighing. You know, sometimes some of our prayers we can't really verbalise. I suppose they're the groanings that can't be uttered. But sometimes our prayers are like that. Sighings. Consider my sighings. Listen to my cry. On the other hand, sometimes they're very audible cries. Listen to my cry for help, my King and my God. For to you I pray. Morning by morning, O Lord, you hear my voice. Morning by morning, I lay my requests before you and wait in expectation. Not only do I lay my requests before you, but I wait in expectation. The picture is, much as we read this morning, of the watchman on the walls, anxiously looking out for the first sign of the message, straining every fibre of his being. Derek Kidner says, "I hold myself in readiness for you," is the sense of this. I lay my requests before you, and then I hold myself in readiness for you to get for the first sign of what you are going to say to me. So in thinking about prayer and in studying about the Psalms, friends, we're in the presence of an expert. David was an expert on prayer. And we were told that we were to help you and to help ourselves to get our acts together this weekend, our ACTS's together about prayer. A is for adoration. C is for confession. T is for thanksgiving. S is for supplication. And so, this first session is A, the second will be about C, and so on. We want to get our acts together about prayer. And David's going to teach us. And so we're going on to Act 1, which is A for adoration. And I've chosen to use for this Psalm 63, which is a psalm that I love and use constantly. Psalm 63. Derek Kidner, you know who Derek Kidner is, says of this psalm, "It is an outpouring of devotion to God, unsurpassed in the Psalter." An outpouring of devotion to God. And as I perceive this psalm, it gives us answers to two key questions. First of all, how can I better express my devotion to God? And the second one that might surprise you, how can I increase my devotion to God? I mean, it's all very well to talk about finding words to express my devotion, but what if I perceive within myself not very much in the way of devotion? We received that little graph last night that went sort of like this, and when I look at my own life and my own prayer life, it's very much that kind of thing. I don't know about you, but sometimes I find myself a bit short on devotion. We, in Papua New Guinea, I often received rather funny letters with patients who came in, and this is one of them. A letter came with a child who had asthma, and the letter said, "Dear Doctor, Francis is suffering from a shortage of inspiration." I've often quoted that. It's absolutely marvellous. A shortage of inspiration. And I reckon that if you and I are suffering from a shortage of inspiration when it comes to adoration, that it very often means there's a shortage of devotion. And we need to look at that. Here's another story I heard via the mouth of Jean Radden. We will get on to the Bible study in a minute. But it was a story of Grace Collins that was one of Jean Radden's favourites, and it was about when Grace Collins was in England during the war, when the rationing was on, and she was in a cafe, and somebody had a cup of tea with sugar. They ordered a cup of tea with sugar, and when they took the first sip, it didn't taste very sweet, so the person called out to the waitress, "Could I have some sugar, please?" And the waitress called back, "Why don't you stir up what you've got?" why don't you stir up what you've got? And by reading psalms of this kind, we are enabled to stir up what we've got in the way of devotion and also to add to what we've got. So this is the purpose of the exercise this morning, friends. You know, when you fell in love with your beloved, did you find yourself short of words to express your devotion? Well, most people don't, I understand, speaking as a single person. So that, you know, if you're short of words, it says something. Maybe you're a bit short on devotion. Okay, let's see what David can do to help us with this. An outpouring of devotion to God unsurpassed in the Psalter. Now, I thought to myself, that's interesting. David wrote many other psalms. What was special about this one? What gave him special inspiration on this occasion? And I believe that the short answer is his pain. The pain of the situation that he was in. You might say that's a strange kind of thing to say. C.S. Lewis, whose writings I find very helpful, at times said this: pain is God's megaphone to a deaf world. Pain is God's megaphone to a deaf world. Do you agree? Pain equips us for ministry in a way that other things cannot do. Do you remember what God told Ananias to tell Paul after that incident on the Damascus Road that totally changed Paul's life when he was blind and Ananias was sent to him with a message from God? Do you remember what that message was? He said, tell him that he's my chosen vessel and I will show him what great things he must suffer for my sake. What a strange thing to say. No details about the ministry. The message was, you're going to suffer great things for my sake. Well, there's no mystery about it. If we read the scriptures, we'll discover that ministry flows out of pain. And Paul's ministry flowed out of pain. And David's ministry flowed out of pain. And if we read in detail the book of Job, which I highly recommend to you, absolutely marvellous book, we will find that Job's severe pain started him, as Anderson puts it in his commentary, exploring into God in a way that he had never done before. And he comes out the other side with the words, while still in the midst of his severe pain, in Job 42, I was talking of things I knew nothing about, things far too dreadful for me. Is that right? No. Things far too wonderful for me. How does he discover those things? Through his pain. How come Johnny has the ministry that she has? As a result of her pain. David himself, possibly on the same occasion as this psalm was written, says in Psalm 4 verse 1, when I was in distress, you enlarged me. Paul's testimony was the same. He said, I want you to know, brethren, to the Corinthians, that I want you to know about the hardships we suffered in Asia, that we were pressed far beyond our ability to endure. Paul, that great man of God, said we were pressed far beyond our ability to endure. If I don't watch myself, we'll be having a talk on stress and coping. But then Paul says, why did this happen to us? We found the sentence of death in our hearts. We were reduced to the complete end of our tether. Why did this happen? Well, first of all, so that we would learn more about trusting God. We learnt to trust him in a way that we had never known before. And then if we go back to that marvellous passage about the comfort of God, Paul says that we experienced the comfort of God and that experience was for you, so that we would be able to comfort you. We would have a ministry of comfort to you. So Paul acknowledged on that occasion and over again that his ministry flowed from pain. I hope I've made that point. I reckon that's the reason why this psalm is an outstanding one as an example of an outpouring of devotion to God. Well, what was the particular occasion? We read at the beginning of this psalm, a psalm of David when he was in the desert of Judah. That's all the information we get. But in verse 11 we read, "But the king will rejoice in God." And Derek Kidner and C.H. Spurgeon and others of that ilk say that probably this means that this psalm was written when David was fleeing from Absalom rather than when he was fleeing from Saul, because at that time David was king. So I'm going to take it that he was fleeing from Absalom at that time. And this makes sense, because apart from the other things that David was at that time, he was a parent in pain. He was a parent in pain. And I don't know whether there are any parents in pain here this morning. I'll guarantee there are. Identify with this man in his particular situation. In 2 Samuel chapters 15 and 16, we read about this. Remember that over a period of 4 years, his son Absalom had systematically undermined David's authority over the people of Israel, subtly, but nevertheless, systematically. And finally, he'd reached the point of usurping David's kingship. And in chapter 15, verse 13, we read that a messenger came and told David, "The hearts of the men of Israel are with Absalom." And to cut a long story short, David fled. Now, oh dear. I also want to recommend this little book to you. I don't know whether you've seen it. It's called A Tale of Three Kings by Jean Edwards. And it's not a long book. It's an excellent one to read. I highly recommend it to you because it deals with David's attitude to the things that happened to him, particularly to Saul's hatred and intent to kill him, as we heard about last night. David's response to the opportunities to kill Saul was to say, "How can I lift my hand against the Lord's anointed?" And then on the occasion of Absalom's turning the hearts of the children of Israel away from him again, David did not retaliate. He fled. All right, so we find him fleeing. And that was the first thing. He was fleeing for his life. And in verse 13 we read that he was rejected and deserted by his people. I'm not looking these up because I'm conscious of the time. He was betrayed by his son. We've already dealt with that. In verse 11, chapter 16, we read, "My son, who is my own flesh, is trying to take my life." Can you imagine that kind of situation? I mean, you're having a lot of pain with your children, perhaps, but it'd be fairly rare that one of your children would be trying to take your life. That's the kind of pain that David was experiencing. We read in chapter 15, verse 30, that David was in deep pain and mourning. And in chapter 16, verse 14, that he was exhausted in the desert. He fled and he was exhausted. And from that situation came this grand outpouring of devotion to God. Derek Kidner says, "Once again, the worst brought out David's best." Once again, the worst brought out David's best. I wonder, does the worst bring out your best? I know it often doesn't bring out my best. And this is why we need to learn from people like David. So let's look now in detail at Psalm 63. And as I see it, it's first of all an expression of David's own deep devotion to God. And secondly, it gives us a description of the pattern of his devotional life. And so we can use it as an expression of devotion when words fail us, but we can also use it as a pattern for our lives. So looking at it first of all as an expression of David's devotion to God. As you read the Psalms, you notice that it was David's habit, when the pressure was on him, to remind himself about God, to focus on God, to home in on God and on his heart relationship with him. You remember that David remained a man after God's own heart. When people are in severe pain, the first question they ask is, why me? Why me? David's answer to that question was, God knows, and that's enough. God knows, and that's enough. All right, let's look at verse 1. O God, you are my God. Earnestly I seek you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you. Or, as I think David would have said, my soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you. As people made in the image of God, we're all aware of that strange restlessness, a strange dissatisfaction deep within us, however fulfilled our lives might appear to other people to be. As Henri Nouwen puts it, our lives are so filled and yet so unfulfilled, and a good deal of the time we're aware of this strange restlessness within us and we don't quite know what the meaning of it is. David knew the meaning of it. He knew that his longing was for God. It was his longing for God. My soul and my body, my whole being, thirst, long for you. As Kidner says, this is not the groping of a stranger, but the eagerness of a friend, almost of a lover, to be in touch with the one he holds dear. Oh God, you are my God. And this, of course, is David perhaps acknowledging or reminding himself of the covenant relationship, the covenant that God made with Abraham, that he would be his God. And of course, the other aspect of it is that not only would God be my God, but I would be his. I am my beloved's, and he is mine. And the fact that David, in this severely stressful situation, could first of all say, oh God, you are my God, reflects his total confidence in the reality of that covenant relationship. And it's also, I believe, an expression of a personally experienced deep relationship, which was the first priority in David's life. What's the first priority in my life, really, and in your life? When it all boils down and comes down to tin tacks, what is the chief end of man? As every Presbyterian knows, it's to glorify God and enjoy him forever. We can say that. But is that really the first priority of our lives? It was of David's. When the pressure was on David, his world being constricted by pain, as pain does to us, when David's world was constricted, it became totally full of God. What a challenge. His total focus was on God as his world became more and more constricted by pain. You're not a God to be worshipped at a distance. You're not somebody else's God. You're mine. And it follows that I'm yours. I belong to you. I'm not alone. I'm not unloved. I'm not useless. I am your unique workmanship, as Paul reminds us in Ephesians. I'm different from everybody else in the world, and God has a special job for me. Oh God, you are my God. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you. As Augustine said, you've made us for yourselves, and our hearts can't find rest until they find rest in you. All right, and again, thinking of Psalm 4, where David says that the Lord has set aside the godly, not for success in this world, not for achievement, not to be the best mother that ever was, or the best wife, or the best doctor, not for any of those things. The Lord has set aside the godly for himself, to be in deep relationship with him. Okay, we better press on. Everything else may be collapsing around me, but this thing stands. This God is our God, as David says in Psalm 48 and verse 14. This God is our God forever and ever. This God who is great and most worthy of praise, whose love is unfailing, is our God. Not just David's God, your God and my God. And not just for today, forever and ever. Can we really grasp hold of that? It's the greatest perspective restorer in the whole world. All right. This is the sort of confidence and devotion that David had. And this didn't happen by chance. It happened as a result of the kind of devotional life that we read about in Psalm 5. Morning by morning, he said, I lay my requests before you and wait in expectation. It wasn't a kind of up and down thing as far as his devotional life was concerned. And if you and I are not to be short of inspiration when it comes to praising the Lord and living the kind of lives that glorify him, then we need to cultivate our devotional life. Now, I brought with me a visual aid. It's my one and only visual aid. It's not the complicated one. As I understand it, that's the blueprint, the pattern of the Christian life. Do you understand that? What does that little sign mean, folks? Sorry, what does that little sign mean? Greater than, or less than, depending on your point of view. Okay, now why do I say that this is the pattern of the Christian life? Well, one of my favourite verses is Proverbs 4 and 18. I dare say that there are a number of people here who could quote that verse. It says, the path of the righteous is like the first gleam of dawn, shining ever brighter till the full light of day. Now, why do I say this is the blueprint, the pattern of the Christian life? Because wherever we happen to be on that path, there is more and more ahead. And the further we go along it, the more we see. You see, this just goes on and on and on to infinity. So that it means that however far we get in the Christian life in this world, we're never going to arrive until that marvellous day when we see him face to face. We're always in this world just going to be able to see as through a glass, darkly. But the good news is that it doesn't matter where you are on the Christian life, that's the pattern of what's ahead. It's absolutely marvellous, and that's what David is talking about in this psalm. Now, who says, I'll go back to it, Psalm 63. Oh God, you are my God, earnestly I seek you. Now, this is step one in the pattern of the devotional life, as David sets it out before us, and as I personally, and no doubt most of you have personally experienced it. Earnestly I seek you. The first step is seeking earnestly. And that word earnestly has two ideas to it. The first is of wholeheartedness, with my whole heart. Now the Bible says, if with all your heart you truly seek me, you will surely find me, says the Lord. But it's got to be a wholehearted thing. Half-hearted seeking for God won't find him. Wholehearted. And it also has the idea of constantly. In other versions, that word is translated early. And when the Bible talks about early in the morning, it has not only the idea of earliness, but the idea of dailiness. So that the two ideas in this word translated earnestly or early are of wholeheartedness and of persistence in seeking. And if we look at Psalm 130, verse 6, we see these two ideas beautifully brought together. And again, it's the same idea that I was talking about on the devotions this morning and that we read about in Psalm 5. Verse 6, my soul waits for the Lord more than watchmen wait for the morning. More than watchmen wait for the morning. The idea of wholehearted devotion and a persistent devotion. My own experience as a Christian began with hearing a sermon preached on the text, Seek and Ye Shall Find. I was converted as an adult in Edinburgh, having finished a degree in agriculture. This is some of the Boer War era information that you were asking for. When I was a student doing agricultural science at Sydney University, before I went to Edinburgh, the people in the Evangelical Union were always trying to convert me for some reason or other, and I was very resistant to that idea on the grounds that they couldn't prove to me that God existed. However good their arguments, I would always retaliate, can you prove to me that God exists? And that'd keep them quiet. When I went to Edinburgh, the first morning I was there, I was really lonely, and so I decided I'd go to church. And the first church I came to was the Church of Scotland. The preacher was Murdo Ewan MacDonald, in case any of you have met him or heard of him, and he was preaching on this text, Seek and ye shall find. Now that was the text for me with my scientific training. Here's something that you can test for yourself. See if it works, said Murdo Ewan MacDonald, and I took him at his word. What was the process? Well, it's really summed up in James 1 and 25. It's cutting a very long story short. And I've loved James from the earliest days. Somebody gave me a copy of J.B. Phillips' paraphrase of the Letters to Young Churches, and I read and read and read that and tried to pray. This is what Murdo MacDonald told me to do, and this went on for months and months and months until finally one day I was convinced that it was true. Seek and you shall find, said the Bible. All right, I sought as wholeheartedly as I could, and I found that it was true. That was in 1955, and nothing's happened since to make me change my mind. In fact, quite the contrary. In James 1 and 25, the process is summarised beautifully, but the man who looks intently into, and those words translated looks intently into, are the same words used of the disciples having run to the tomb and seeing the stone moved away, looking intently into. Can you imagine their feelings, their emotions, as they looked into that tomb to see what was there or not there, how they peered through that gloom? That's the word, that's the attitude with which we're to come to the Word of God. Peering into. The man who looks intently into the perfect law that gives freedom and continues earnestly. Not only does it mean wholeheartedly, it means daily, constantly. and continues to do this, not forgetting what he has heard, but doing it, putting it into practice, he will be blessed in what he does. My testimony is, folks, that's absolutely true. That's how I came to know the Lord. But the point is that that was just the beginning of the Christian life of seeking, finding, discovering, putting into practice what you found, seeing more, seeking for more, finding more, obeying what you find, and so on and so on. But of course, one doesn't always obey, being human. And there have been long periods of my life where I've stagnated. And a number of those years occurred while I was on the mission field, of all places. And I was desperately busy. The only doctor in charge of a health centre that was looking after 20,000 people, working night and day, getting tighter and tighter. And what went out the window? My devotional life. And I rationalised it along these lines. Oh, Lord, you know that everything I'm doing is for you. And I know you know my frame, my limitations. Very similar story to the story of Martha, if you think about it. And the Lord dealt with me in a similar way, through a very painful experience. I'm not wanting to be legalistic about this, and I'm not saying to you, you've got to do the same, but I'm just sharing my experience. That when the Lord dealt with me, I realised that I had to add something to my overbusy life. I had to add a regular, disciplined, devotional life, which for me involved getting up at 5 a.m. come what may, even if I just got to bed at 4 a.m. And I found that things began gradually to change in my life. And how did they change? Along the kinds of lines that David's talking about here. We're not supposed to be doing a study of my life, we're supposed to be doing a Bible study of Psalm 63. So let's get back to that, folks. Step number two, finding in verse 2. Don't be discouraged that we're only up to verse 2. We're going to get it to accelerate shortly. So longing, insert before I have seen. The commentators tell us that those words, at least the word so, really should occur, and in the original Aramaic occurs before I have seen. So David is saying, looking back and saying, in those days, those other days when I longed for you in this kind of way, this was what happened. I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. David was in the wilderness then, but it said an enormous amount for David's understanding and knowledge of God in the days before Christ, that he knew that God could be found just as surely, as certainly in the wilderness as he could in the sanctuary. His expectation was that God would satisfy his longing in the wilderness in just the same way as he did in the sanctuary. And so he's reminding God, as he often did in Psalms, in his prayers, so longing, I have seen you in the sanctuary and beheld your power and your glory. That's how it was before, that's how I expect it to be now. Because your love is better than life. And Stuart Briscoe tells me, and I haven't seen it in any other commentary, that this really is lives, not life. Not only is your love better than life, and most of us think life is the main thing, that's the thing that we cling to grimly, come what may, our physical life, it's all we know, it's all we have. David says God's love is better not only just than one life, it's better than half a dozen lives. Those were the things that I discovered in the sanctuary. How much more am I going to discover in my pain? Job, at the end of his experience, said, and remember that he was a man who was totally devoted to the Lord and did all possible to do the right thing in his devotional life. At the end of his painful experience, he said, previously I'd just heard about you, Now I've seen you. What made the difference? His pain. Okay. So David's expectation is that God will reveal more of himself to him in the wilderness, and he reminds himself of what he had discovered before. He said, if you're feeling this has a kind of circularity about it, it's true, but it's a spiral staircase, the direction being upwards, this seeking and finding business. I mean, you start off with your original seeking and finding, you come to the Lord and you see more opening up and you seek along those lines, so the spiral starts to go up and up and up and up. This is what David's telling us about in this psalm, by recalling what it was like in the sanctuary. All right, so let's just list the outcomes of finding, or what the things were that David talks about finding. Verse 5, as a result of my earnest seeking, I know that, verse 5, my soul will be satisfied as with the richest of foods. My soul will be abundantly satisfied as a result of what the Lord is going to give me in response to my desperate search for him. Compare verse 1, my soul thirsts for you, that's the seeking, with verse 5, my soul will be abundantly satisfied. That's what God does in response to our search for him. Isn't that amazing? Isn't it marvellous? But that's the kind of God that we have. My soul will be abundantly satisfied. And if we look back at Psalm 62 verse 1, we find David saying, my soul finds rest in God alone. Nothing else satisfies. All of us, whether we're Christians or not, have this unsatisfied longing for God. Those who are not Christians haven't correctly identified it. But David had. My soul finds rest in God alone. So what did he find? He found, first of all, satisfaction. Secondly, he found a desire, a longing to worship God. Verse 3. Because I've discovered, in brackets, that your love is better than lives, half a dozen lives, my lips will glorify you. I don't have to drum up praise. It bursts out of me, it flows out of me, because I've come to realise that your love is 6 times, 1,000 times better than life. And so therefore, I glorify you. My lips will glorify you. Verse 4, I will praise you as long as I live. I won't be able to stop praising you as long as I keep on remembering what you're like and reminding myself of what you're like. And in your name I will lift up my hands in worship and in supplication. And the third thing, intensified longing. You see, this longing is satisfied as we earnestly seek the Lord, but then it's replaced by an even deeper longing. And this is what David's expressing. His physical situation in the wilderness of being deprived of physical comforts merely reflected his spiritual experience. Yes, I have been satisfied, but now my longing is even greater than it was before, because I've just caught a glimpse, just a tiny glimpse of what you're like. This is the more than experience. I've just begun to catch a glimpse of what's in the distance, and as a result, I long for more of you. My soul thirsts for you. My body longs for you in a way that I've never known before. Sidlo Baxter put it, of the Christian man, all his discoveries about the Lord only made him see how much more there was to discover. That's the blueprint. All his discoveries only made him see how much more there was to discover. Oh dear, it's 8:30. I better think about winding up, seeing we're 15 minutes late already. Fourth thing is, it changes me. I can't ever be the same again. And this is what Job is recording. Previously, I'd just heard about you. Now I've seen you. My whole life is totally changed. And let's hurry through the last few verses. And it's changed in this way. Verse 6, I'm preoccupied with you. Tozer said, we're called to an everlasting preoccupation with God. And this is another way of expressing what David's been saying. On my bed, I remember you. I asked Effie this morning how she'd slept, and she said, the secret things belong to God. I guess there are a few of you here who feel that way, and not only here, but perhaps at other times. We spend a fair bit of time at night tossing and turning and interminably mulling over all kinds of things. Friends, it's a marvellous opportunity for prayer, for pondering the Word of God. I'm sure many of you have discovered that. The best time, nobody's going to disturb you then. The only thing that's going to disturb you is yourself, your own interminable mullings over things that probably will never happen anyway. On my bed, David said, I remember you. I think of you through the watches of the night. The watches of the night gives the idea of a thing passing very slowly. I spend that time thinking about you. And some of us find it's a good way of getting back to sleep again for some reason or other. Okay. An increasing preoccupation with you. Number two thing, a deepening awareness, verses 7 and following, of being under God's protection, close to him, helped and strengthened by him. I don't want to stop before I've shared these three beautiful pictures. The first one is verse 7, because you are my help, I sing, and the commentators say it should be, I sing for joy in the shadow of your wings. I sing for joy in the shadow of your wings. It's a picture of total confidence and trust. The chicken under the hen's wings can't even see what's happening. You can't see the chicken, so the chicken can't see you. But the chicken is perfectly content to stay there because it knows that the mother hen has everything under control. It can see what's happening, and if any action is needed, it'll take it. The picture of perfect confidence and trust, and a picture too of being in a refuge that adjusts itself to your needs. Loving parental affection adjusts itself to your size and shape, the size and shape of your problems. A living thing, not like a cave, where David spent a fair bit of time in various caves. Caves are not alive, and they don't adapt themselves to you, and moreover, they can turn out to be traps just as easily as refuges, as David also discovered when he found Saul closing in on him. So that's the first picture of total confidence. And in verse 8, I stay close to you. Your right hand upholds me. I stay close to you. Now that I stay close is a picture of being tightly sealed together. And interestingly, the reference is to Job 41, where that word is also used, of the relationship of the scales of a crocodile to one another. That's the degree of closeness. I don't know how much you know about crocodiles. I know a little bit, mostly about how to fix up the results of their close encounters with humans. But you will perhaps recognise the fact that the scales of a crocodile are very closely together. That's the kind of closeness that David's talking about. I think Spurgeon it is who says, sticking like glue, the relationship between the Lord and me. But there's also the idea in this of hot pursuit. My soul follows hard upon you, I think the AV has. So there are these twin ideas in this beautiful little picture. First of all, of abiding in Christ and of Christ dwelling in our hearts. And secondly, of following hard upon him in his steps. So again, there's the picture of total confidence, closeness and trust. The second beautiful picture that I want to talk about is of being upheld. Your right hand upholds me, the end of verse 8. And Stuart Briscoe talks about being God's right-hand man in the world. I like that idea, being God's right-hand man in the world. But it also, of course, has the picture of the strength of God. And the fact of the same kind of idea as of a toddler who's just learning to walk and the Lord's hand upholding him. That's how the Lord is to me. And finally, and I'm really going to finish with this, folks, in the last few verses, David talks about his ever-deepening confidence in God. First of all, that those who seek my life will be destroyed. They'll be given over to the sword and become food for jackals. But God will in the end be seen to have destroyed those who are in opposition to him, and ultimately will be seen to have destroyed the destroyer over whom the victory has already been won, but ultimately this will be seen to have happened. And secondly, the king will rejoice in the Lord. David knew that God would in the end vindicate him, that his kingly calling was real, however things may seem. And as Kidner points out, if David knew that, how much more should we who belong to him believe and have confidence in our calling? So, just in short, if our prayers are to express our adoration to God, our devotion to God, we need to have an ever-deepening devotion that will flow out. And this flows out as we maintain our devotional life along the lines that David's talking about. We're a transferred people. We've been transferred from the dominion of darkness to the kingdom of his dear Son. But we are a being transformed people, and that blueprint applies wherever we are in the Christian life, and the direction that we're to take is to earnestly seek him and find him, be satisfied, and then to move on, to obey and to move on, to seek and to find him more.